You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this evening's event. Before I say anything else, let me introduce our brilliant panel. I'm so very grateful to have these people here tonight. Professor Chris Rapley is Professor of Climate Science at UCL, Director of the British Antarctic Survey for 9 years. Lord Nicholas Stern, for many, the globally recognized authority on climate change. Author of the Stern Review in 2006. Baroness Jenny Jones is the Green Party member for the London Assembly and former Deputy Mayor of London. Jake White, environmental lawyer at Friends of the Earth and a long-term government advisor on legal issues, including those relating to climate. Solitaire Townsend on my left, director and co-founder of Futera, one of the world's most renowned sustainable communication agencies. Ro Randall, a psychotherapist at the end, member of the Climate Psychology Alliance and co-founder of Carbon Conversations, and Jeremy Leggett, globally recognised green energy entrepreneur and founder of Solar Century, which is the UK's fastest growing renewable energy company. Now, before we do anything else, a round of applause, please, for our wonderful guests. Okay, I'm Jonathan Rice, and I sort of lead the RSA's work on climate change. So I'm going to speak now for 2 minutes about what this is about, to set the scene for the others who are going to speak about what the main issue is in their domain. So the main issue for me, as not being in one of these seven dimensions, but speaking about this context of the seven dimensions of climate change, is how did we get to this point? So in 2013, I was minding my own business, working mostly in the area of behavior change, which was still a relatively sort of new area in certain ways, when I got a phone call from the Climate Change Collaboration, who support a lot of work on climate change, and they say, can you think about how your work on behavior change might speak to climate change? And I thought, well, that sounds interesting. I'll look into it. And it began with something relatively simple relating to sort of energy-saving devices. And the more I looked into climate change, the more I thought about it, the more I felt it didn't stop. Any line of inquiry led to several other lines of inquiry. That if you wanted to look at behavior change, you also had to look at rebound effects of behavior change and impacts on cultural norms and social norms. And you had to look at economic incentives. And you had to look at what was happening in the political system. And you had to look at globally what was going on. And then you had to pay attention to the micro elements and fracking and nuclear energy and all of these different things. It becomes overwhelming. And actually, towards the end of that year, I was actually really struggling emotionally, psychologically, to sort of deal with it all. It's quite heavy. Partly for that reason, our first event in the series was a climate comedy event, which happened about a month ago in this room. You can see clips of that online. But the result of that was a big report making sense of climate change from my perspective. And to distill that report, I thought, well, how can we make climate change just simple enough to keep people's attention and draw them in, but not so simple that you lose the integrity and authentic, you know, the sort of the integrity of the problem remains intact. And with that, I had two heuristics to help me along. One was a quotation by Albert Einstein. He always comes along when you're looking for something like this. It tends to be an Einstein quote for it. But this one was, everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. And I thought that was very useful with respect to climate change. It's how can we reduce this problem? Some say it's really simple. Do something or we're screwed. Others, that's David Roberts, by the way, not me. He's a journalist in the US. Others, like Professor Mike Hume at King's College, who deeply understands the climate problem, so deeply it hurts sometimes, but he writes about it much more like an inquiry into what it is to be human, that climate change raises all these deep questions about who we are and what we value and what we care about. But that's not really simple enough to keep people's attention. So the second heuristic that helps us along the way is a famous study by George Miller called The Magic Number 7 Plus or Minus 2. Some of you may have heard of this. It's a 1950s paper in cognitive psychology, and it's about the number of items in our working memory we can comfortably deal with without any special tools or techniques. And with that in mind, I thought, if I could reduce the climate change problem to seven main elements, what would it be? And it was, and we have the sort of representatives here tonight. So we have science, represented by Chris, and we have technology, represented by Jeremy, and we have... don't worry, I do actually know these. We have law represented tonight by Jake, and then we have economy represented by Nick. We have culture represented by Solitaire. We have behavior represented by Ro, and we have democracy represented by Jenny. Now, there are different ways of ordering them, but science tends to be at the beginning because that's the one that sets out the stall and clarifies the purpose. So I'm going to first of all open up to Chris to tell me what the main issue is in that dimension of the problem, and how might we begin to overcome it. So I'll pass you over in the first instance to Chris Rapley.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. Well, science has revealed this issue, and that in itself is interesting, that this is an issue that we wouldn't necessarily be aware of from our own direct experience. So I'd just like to give you a personal two-minute account of my own view on where we are. I've been a scientist all my career, a practical scientist in the early days. I was actually what you'd call a rocket scientist, which gives me free rein to speak authoritatively on virtually anything. But I've had quite a varied career. So unlike many scientists who've tended to stay and become great specialists in a particular area, I've developed research groups, I've led international programs, I've led large labs, and I've also been director of the Science Museum. So I've seen the science actually of climate change or Earth system science through many different lenses. Recently, I've been working with neuroscientists and others to try and understand how my primary instrument, my Mark I brain, works, something that I discovered with a bit of a shock that I'd rather neglected over the years. And it's just emphasised to me the extent to which we are all prone to biased assimilation, to motivated reasoning, and so on. And although the scientific process weeds that out so that in the end truth emerges, it's very helpful if the individual scientists are striving very hard to scrutinise their own thought and logic processes to ensure that they don't suffer from those. And so what I feel that I've been doing over the last few years is asking myself some very hard questions about the narrative of climate change to convince myself of my position. And my position is the position of many, many of my colleagues, the vast majority. That is that climate change is real, it's happening. Of course, climate has changed for all sorts of reasons on all sorts of timescales over the long history of the Earth. This time, the primary driver is human activity, the release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and other impacts on land use, for example, or the surface of the Earth, that this is already beginning to have impacts. So it's very interesting to see how the business community is beginning to take this more and more seriously as they feel the impacts on their supply chains, on their future investments, as they look into the future, trying to decide where it's safe and where not safe to invest. And that there are things that we can do about it, although there is this lacuna in that what is being done is minuscule compared with what the science says needs to be done. And the bottom line of the science is that there is a limited amount of fossil fuel left that we can burn. And the issue for society informed by that science is how to decarbonise the world economy and not burn beyond that limit. And we can argue exactly what that limit is, but the principle is there. And the final thing I would say is that the science will always have irreducible uncertainties, but that doesn't mean that one shouldn't act. There is no other area of human activity or policy where absolute certainty is required. And so in the military, in economics, in all other walks of life, one deals with the information one has as best one can, and there are ways that that can be dealt with, which we can talk about later if you like. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. Jeremy.
When it comes to technology and climate change, I think there are reasons to be cheerful. From where I'm sitting on a serial front line, it seems to me that we are in danger of winning on this issue. And there are three main reasons for this. There are three mega trends emerging in the modern world that should offer us hope. The first is that the incumbents, the people who are fueling climate change, are very much on a frontier. Because they're on a frontier, their costs are going up, are soaring. I can't go into the detail of this, but I really, if you're not following it on Bloomberg, please do. It's a great drama. If you want evidence of what's happening, just go and look in the US shale, where the first bankruptcies have started because of the high cost of production and the low cost at which they can sell oil and gas. And this is an accidental development in the history of the world, but it's vital towards the undermining, frankly, of a polluting technology. A second trend, completely disconnected from this and fortuitous, again, for climate reasons, is that the cost of the survival technologies, the clean energy technologies, particularly solar and storage, are going down spectacularly fast, faster even than the industry itself has projected. And if you wanted evidence of this, I would suggest you go to Germany and look at the soaring use of renewables in the German energy sector and the fact that Germany's biggest utility, E.ON, just before Christmas, announced it was doing a 180-degree turn on its business model. It's parking all the incumbency technologies, fossil fuels and nuclear, in a bad bank, and it's running it at cash and running it down. All the growth is going to be focused on renewables and energy efficiency and clean, smart, new 21st century stuff. And I emphasize this is Germany's biggest utility. So these two things, you notice I haven't mentioned climate change yet. But the third thing, of course, is climate policy. And we're living in a world where we can't overstate it, but we dare to live in hope because the biggest emitters get it. The Obama White House gets it, wants it to be a legacy issue, has struck a deal with China, who definitely get it because their politicians tend to be engineers and they understand that their economy is on the coastal plain and they are going to lose their coastal plain on current trajectory. So the Americans and the Chinese have struck a deal that could be the heart of a rapprochement in Paris. We can live in hopes. These three things all come together, and we should do everything we can to maximize their impact on society and the world in the direction we want to go.
Brilliant. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I guess I'd start by saying that law is an instrument. Law is a mechanism. It's a mechanism by which we deliver change, but I think it's also a means by which we come together and we debate and we exchange ideas and we enshrine a kind of a settlement, a consensus, ideally, in a document. So on the one hand, I think as a mechanism, it seems somewhat neutral. We would say, well, what's really important is content. And there, I guess we would say, well, this international climate deal that we're pursuing, that we think certainly at Friends of the Earth is very important, needs to be equitable. It needs to bring about significant reductions in carbon emissions. It needs to be science-based. It needs to ensure that adequate compensation is made available for those states who are already feeling the consequences of climate change. So on the one hand, I guess you would say it's a mechanism and therefore it's not terribly significant. But as I've already said, I think on the other hand, it is quite significant because I think, as I say, it's a means by which we come together and we debate and we achieve and we capture a consensus. I think the other aspect in other regard in which it's significant is we saw in the Copenhagen talks, which obviously culminated without legal agreement. And I think that the media coverage that you saw after Copenhagen was very significant in the sense that it focused quite heavily on the absence of the fact that this was a binding agreement. And therefore, was it really worth the paper it was written on? Obviously, there are questions about enforceability in international law, but despite that fact, the debate that we have around something that is at least notionally binding is, I think, still productive. At a national level, I think in some ways we're quite lucky because we have the Climate Change Act, something of a world leader. At EU level, international level, I think the difficulties are perhaps much, much greater. I think we see the system by which we seek to bring about legal agreement is itself, I think, quite difficult. So that's this ongoing 25-year process of international negotiations, which seems quite sclerotic. I think also law can at times deliver quite technocratic solutions to problems. So we get talking about parts per million and things of this kind. And it's those kinds of debates where I think we can lose people. But overall, law I see as a mechanism for change and for good.
Thank you very much, Jake. Nick, please.
I come at this as an economist, basically an academic economist who's been working on development, poverty reduction, growth, policy all my life. But I have this irrepressible urge to try to change the world. The world isn't always very grateful. Particularly when you see the enormous risks of climate change. So that's who I am. The first point I wanted to make was that the science, it's all your fault, Chris, has made this as politically difficult as it could possibly be. One is that it's about uncertainty, and we as human beings are not very good at that. The second is that it's about scale, which is quite extraordinary. 3 degrees centigrade, and we're headed for way above 3 degrees centigrade with a quite strong probability. We haven't seen for 3 million years. We've been around as humans for maybe 250,000 with a fairly generous definition of sapiens. And this is way outside human experience, way outside. And we're not very good at contemplating things so far outside experience. The third thing is it comes with lags. You don't see, we are running over children in the road, but you don't see it immediately. So we're drunk in charge of the world, but the consequences of driving drunk are down the track. And we're not very good at that either. And lastly, the atmosphere doesn't notice whether that ton of CO2 or whatever other greenhouse gas came from Johannesburg, Beijing, London, or wherever. It's the sum total of what we do that matters. So if you put those four, and it's all the science's fault, Chris, it's that's basic science. And that makes it very difficult for people to understand. So we have to try ourselves to share our ideas, check our language, but to try, and this is my second point, to show that this is a problem of the management of enormous risk, risks which we wouldn't contemplate for a moment in our personal lives in terms of probability of that plane arriving at its destination. And we have to change radically. We have to reduce emissions per unit of output in the next 35 years by a factor of 7 or 8. We have to cut it 2.5, factor 2.5 absolutely if we'd have a reasonable chance of 2 degrees, and with a bit of luck and good management, the economy might grow by a factor of 3 or so in 35 years, whether we like it or not. And that means you multiply those two together, you've got to reduce emissions per unit of output by a factor of 6, 7, 8. That is radical change. Well, the third point is that this is really good news, because this is enormous opportunity. If you look back at past his industrial revolutions, technological change, you can have radical change and innovation and investment and growth. Actually, they come together. This is a real opportunity. It's a growth story. The sustainable growth story is the growth story of the future. So what you've got is a world that's fundamentally changing. You've got 3.5 billion people in cities now. It will be 6.5 billion by 2050. How we manage those cities, an enormous opportunity to make it cleaner, quieter, safer, and so on. You've got technical change at a more rapid pace than it's ever been in human history, in digital, in materials, and in bio, and so on. You've got this moment where we have to reduce climate change because delay is extremely dangerous, and you've got interest rates on the floor. If that isn't an opportunity, I don't know what is.
Brilliant. Thanks very much, Nick. And Jenny, please.
Thank you. As a Green Party politician, acceptance of the science of climate change is a fairly basic requirement. But what I find is, quite often, I am the only person in the room or the house that actually feels that it is something that we all have to deal with, and we have to deal with urgently. So this evening is something quite special for me. Being in a panel of people that accept it's happening is absolutely fantastic. I am elected at the London Assembly, and there, there's only 2 Greens out of an assembly of 25 people, and that means that we have to work with the other political parties if we're going to get anything done. And one way, of course, of getting things done is to work through the mayor and try to encourage the mayor of London to do greener things. This is incredibly difficult because he does not accept the science of climate change. And what I've found is generally that, in fact, it is such a big issue, as Nick has just been saying, that people don't want to believe it. So when I talk to conservatives in particular, but Labour is nearly as bad. When I talk to them, they just don't want to admit. They'll say, well, the science isn't conclusive. And I say, well, the IPCC says global warming is unequivocal and that humanity's role in causing it is clear. But they just can't accept it. I think part of that is it's too terrifying. It's too big. It suggests that the way things are going can't continue, and nobody wants to contemplate that. And also, of course, there are vested interests. People, you know, they have their pensions funds locked up in fossil fuels, and they don't want to have to do the enormous amount of work to find other ways of making money. I was talking to somebody today, a conservative woman, who started telling me about Pakistan and how there's 180 million people in Pakistan who need energy, and they have the fourth largest coal seam or coal field under Pakistan, and so they have to use that. And I was saying, but surely Pakistan's got quite a lot of sun, and wouldn't it be better to actually make every single house a little mini power station? And she was saying, yes, yes, but 180 million people, that's just too many. And I felt I'm not getting anywhere with this. we're experiencing at the moment a very unusual political situation. Politics has suddenly become interesting. We had the Scottish referendum. They laughed. Why did they laugh? We had the Scottish referendum, which suddenly people seemed to feel their vote counted, and so they signed up for it. We then had, of course, the rise of UKIP, and for every person who doesn't like the message, for every person who likes the message of UKIP, there are probably a dozen who are looking for an antidote. And then, of course, various other factors have suddenly made people more aware. In the Green Party, we've seen what we've been calling a green surge, but I don't know where these people are coming from. I don't know if they suddenly understand that this is an important issue or if they're just angry with the other parties. I've got no idea. It'll be very interesting to find out.
Okay, thanks a lot. Solitaire.
Thank you very much. And having been a Green Party member for more than 5 years, I feel very smug to have got in there first. So it's increasingly a badge of honour. So I've been asked to talk on culture, which is quite a big subject. I think I've got the biggest subject compared to everybody else. And also one of the key parts of culture is it's very difficult as an individual to talk about the culture you're in, or indeed the culture that 7 billion of us are in. So I'm going to ask you to help me. So please raise your hands if you're scared, afraid, fear climate change and the impacts it's going to have. Who in here is afraid?
For those watching at home or listening at home, that's about 80%, 90%. That's,
yeah. Now, I'm going to ask you a question that you probably don't get asked as often, which is who here believes that we're going to make it, that the technology, that the transition, that the infrastructure that many of the panelists spoke about is going to happen fast enough and big enough, and by the skin of our teeth, we're going to make it past?
Okay. That's about a third, I think.
About a third. And this is essentially what, for me, the cultural conversation is. It's about the semiotics, the symbols, the languages, and the very deep beliefs that we have around culture change. Because if culturally, if in our dynamic, in our conversations, both on the news, in politics, in The Simpsons, in The Daily Show, if there is a cultural belief that we're going to lose this fight, then the macro psychology would suggest that we will. Whereas if there's a cultural belief that we will win this fight, then macro psychology suggests that that becomes more likely, or at least possible. And I was reflecting on the Keep Calm and Carry On poster, which, of course, was never used. Until now, massively. Because it was prepared by the Ministry of Information for invasion. There was, however, another poster that was used and was incredibly successful at the time. It was the first poster that was ever published by the Ministry of Information in the Second World War. And it reads, "Your courage, your cheerfulness and your resolution will bring us victory." And that kind of positioning, your courage, your cheerfulness, your positivity, your hope and your resolution, your decision that this is winnable and that we can do it, is crucially, crucially important. And when I think about some of the language and some of the stories that we tell ourselves at the moment, not just our stories of climate change, but reflecting on words such as developed versus developing country. Bloody awful is that. We live in a developed country, an end state. As good as it gets. The death of progress. This is the apotheosis of the human experience. This is the absolute pinnacle of what we can hope and expect. How awful would it be to be a 14-year-old living in a developed country? When it comes to climate change, of course, we are a developing country. And how much more exciting is that? So part of my hope around the conversation around culture is that we can bring back the idea of progress.
Thank you very much. And thanks for inventing a new academic discipline of macro psychology. Appreciate that. Bro.
Well, I'm here to talk about behaviour, but I'm actually a psychoanalytically trained psychotherapist. So to me, behaviour is the surface phenomena. And beneath that, we are all, in some sense, creatures of conflict made up of competing desires and impulses. And I think this has some relevance to how we understand people's experience of an issue like climate change. I was very interested in Solitaire asking you all whether you were afraid about climate change. Because one of the things I often do with an audience is ask them at the start to call out what they feel about the issue, to see what kind of audience I've got in front of me. often people find it quite hard to identify the feeling. Once they do, it's very often quite negative. People say they're afraid, they're scared, they're panicky, they've got a knot in their stomach. Some people say they're angry, which is quite an interesting one too. But overall, the responses are negative. And one of the things which we learn from psychotherapy is that when people feel anxious, and I think this is actually the dominant emotion that people experience about climate change, is that when we feel anxious, we need to defend ourselves. And one of the most common ways that... Well, there are a lot of very common ways that this is done. We may avoid the subject, or we may regress into states where we imagine that some sort of superhero is going to come along and solve it all for us. But most commonly, we get into a state which psychotherapists call disavowal, but which I've come to call everyday denial. This is a state where we know in one part of our conscious mind that climate change is happening and it's very serious, but in another part of our minds, we behave as if it simply isn't true. And this explains, I think, why when you're chatting at the water cooler with people, they may refer to something that they're doing about climate change. Perhaps they're an architect, they're putting in some solar panels for somebody, and then the conversation just segues seamlessly into talk about where they're going for their holidays, as if their flights had nothing to do with it. And I think that this is one of the most interesting things about all of our responses to climate change, is that we need to defend ourselves against experiencing deeply what it means. And I think that this is something which tends to lead us towards distortions of reality. We tend to believe in things which may not be true. We believe that technology by itself will save us. We don't have to do anything. We haven't even got to change the light bulb. Or we believe that efficiency will save us and we don't have to do anything. Our lives may not have to change. So we're full of these kinds of hopes. And I think if people are to actually face the difficulties that we're in, they need what psychotherapists refer to as containment, and which is what is sometimes referred to as a safe space, somewhere where people can feel both challenged and supported, and they then become able to talk about what we all actually need to do, and that's what most of my work's to do with.
This is an interesting bit because we call tonight Climate Question Time, and typically in Question Time you seek out, you ask your audience to write you some questions, you choose some, and you ask them. We've done that this evening. We've done one for each dimension. We have written about this. You may have seen this coming in. We've already written a short document just to introduce this concept of the seven dimensions of climate change. And it was about trying to have a multilateral conversation. A lot of climate change is unilateral. It's scientists saying, this is what's going on. Or it's scientists speaking to economists saying, this is what's going on, what's possible. Or sometimes it's people working for behavior change, speaking to people in social marketing and culture. But quite rarely is it multilateral, getting everyone on board. So that's difficult. There aren't many mediums for it. A 1.25-hour medium like this isn't even quite right. But we're trying to demonstrate what is almost possible with the hope that others will try and sort of do something similar in other contexts where perhaps there's more time. Now, on that note, first question on science. And it's a question from Claire O'Connor, who simply asked, is there still a chance for mitigation or is it time to think about adaptation? And Chris, if you could begin with that, please.
Okay, well, the answer is we'd better not be in the pure adaptation camp because as Nick said, on our present carbon trajectory, we're heading towards the real possibility of a 4-degree world or maybe even a 5 or 6-degree world in the longer term. And there's absolutely no reason to believe that that would be easy to adapt to. It would be a pretty dramatic change. As Nick said, the human race has never confronted that world. We in the last 100 years, we've invested a whole load of money, but actually we've invested 530,000 million tons of carbon as energy to build and construct a world which, by and large, is engineered confront the climate system we inherited, which has been extraordinarily stable since we came out of the last ice age. The Holocene, this last 7,000 years, is quite extraordinary. And the climate record, as you look back, you don't find that degree of stability, no more than about a degree of wobbling on that system over that last 10,000 years. So all of our agriculture, our water supplies, our infrastructure, I travel on the railways, and the slightest extreme that they confront causes disruption. So our systems aren't even well matched to the climate system we inherited. And we're driving it into another state. Now, if we were driving it into another fixed state, we could rebuild the world. It costs a lot of money. And adapt to it would be very disruptive. But what concerns me is that we're driving it into a state that may be less stable, back into the state that it's been in for as long as we can tell from the climate science. So this is the risk. A 4-degree world could not only have extremes, but it could have instabilities that we would find very difficult to manage.
Sure. And Jeremy, you mentioned earlier you might be winning, or the conditions might be in place for beginning to win. But my understanding is that on technology, there are many people making a case for investment in adaptation technologies, which is often competing with those that are advocating the same thing for mitigation. And by the way, just to clarify, by mitigation, we typically mean making the problem significantly worse, and by adaptation, we mean adapting to the problem when it arrives.
Yeah, that's true. But if you allow me 10 seconds on what 4 degrees means, that's very clear to me. We lose the ability to feed the vast majority of the world and to provide most of the world with potable drinking water. And that's where the problems start at 4 degrees. And I think the scientific evidence is really clear for that. So these are the stakes that we should be really clear on. In the technical community, a lot of the problem we have, and this is where it ties into the neuroscience and the cultural aspects, most of the major decisions on the technologies and companies that are actually literally fueling the problem are made by a relatively small number of human beings who are mostly men of a certain age, close to retirement, who find great difficulty in changing their belief systems. There are very few women involved in this decision making. And 2/3 of the emissions causing the problem come from just 90 companies. Recent study. 90 companies. Now, it's really simple. We either have to persuade those companies to fundamentally change their business models, as E.ON has done, or is in the process of trying to do, or we have to put them out of business. It's not that big a challenge. And on the technology, at that level, and on the technology front, many of those men whose Meccano sets were way too big when they were little boys, we'll look at technology and we'll say, you know what, we have a problem. So what we have to do is invent carbon capture and storage. Never mind about adaptation. They want to do abatement with technology that they either know can't work or have no idea whether it's going to be economic in the case of carbon capture storage. Wonderful example. There should be thousands of CCS projects in the world by now. There are 13. They don't work economically, and that includes recycling the carbon dioxide, to boost the production in oil fields.
Okay. Thanks very much. I wanted to ask Ro there. Psychologically, this conventional wisdom is if you start talking about adaptation, people think we're giving up. That somehow, if we start moving away from dealing with climate change as a discrete problem to something that is already happening, we can do nothing about, and we now have to deal with. I know it's not that simple, but how is it experienced when you talk to people about those relative things of addressing the problem now and accepting that the problem will be with us for the foreseeable future?
I think sometimes people look at adaptation as the easy option. I think it's quite bizarre in a way, because mitigation means that people have actually got to engage with doing something now, whereas adaptation seems to put it off, and people like to think of themselves as adaptable. It's a positive quality. So the language, I think, I'm sure Solitaire would agree with me here, the language is wrong, because adaptation is something that says you're a flexible, good person. Right. Whereas mitigation doesn't really mean very much to people. And when you do explain it, they say, I don't know. So there's a very interesting thing there, I think, about framing as well.
Okay, thanks very much.
Can I come in just on that?
Course,
I mean, sometimes it's helpful, the language can be helpful. Sometimes we think of mitigation as avoiding the unmanageable and adaptation as managing the unavoidable. And if you express it that way, you obviously have to do both. And the less you do of the former, the more you have to do on the latter. But we'd be completely bonkers not to adapt to a changing world. Why would anybody not do that? What you're trying to do is adapt as best you can and stop it changing too much.
So, come to technology in a second. This is where seven-dimensional perspective, I want to say something briefly, which is that where you have a position like that that seems altogether like common sense, you immediately think, well, in order to get the political will for that, you have to mobilize the population on that. But the level of the population you're dealing with human experience, where people still hear, yes, we have to adapt to a changing world, and yes, we have to minimize the problem. But many people will think of it in binary terms as one or the other, even if the reality is that we need to do both. That's my experience, is that problems arise from things like that. Technology. Mary Ryan, please.
Hi, thank you, panel. And I think we've actually heard a little bit from Jeremy on my question, which was, could we hear some views from the panel about the merits of carbon capture technologies? Thanks.
I mean, I've said my piece on CCS. I'm interested to hear what Nick has to say about it. My view is that the incumbency, and here, again, the neuroscience is important because the neuroscientists tell us that we have this tendency towards an incumbency effect, an endowment effect. You know, we defend what we have that, seems defensible, even though there are things that are logically much better, like clean energy technologies. And I think CCS is very much part of that. And it's a last-ditch defense. It's failing. And actually now we're at a point where it's clearly so uneconomic that any significant amount that's put into it will take resources away from the survival technologies and strategies.
So we'll hear from Nick in a second, but just the problem with CCS, carbon capture, is that people do still speak of it whenever they project into the future about this is how the economy will be. Is it a completely hopeless case, or is it something that there's actually hope
for?
I
mean, it can be done. I'm a geologist. I know it can be done. But, we've heard about it for so long, and they've been putting it up as a chimera for so long. And, by now, there should be hundreds, if not thousands, of industrial-scale projects, because they've been talking about it for so long. There are 13, and we know they don't work economically.
So, good example. Why don't they work economically, Nick?
You would need a price of CO2 in the medium term, we guess, of around $50 a ton of CO2. You'd need way over 100 now with current technologies, but if there was strong investment, most people's guess is that a $50 a ton CO2 carbon price would support quite a lot of carbon capture and storage. That's a very low carbon price. United States has got 35, 36, 37 as their official carbon price. And it's absolutely clear that the models they've been using to generate that, and I've published on that, as I would have done, are way, way too conservative.
Okay.
So if we had a sensible carbon price, it's ballpark 100 euro in Sweden, a ton of CO2, you could support it, but it would need a lot of investment, big scale. My view is that this problem is so serious that it would be reckless to throw away anything, and we ought to be investing very strongly in learning as much as we can about how to bring down the cost of CCS, how to bring down the cost of nuclear, and make it safe.
Okay.
But I think our best bet, and the evidence is pointing more and more strongly in that direction, is renewables plus storage. Okay. But I wouldn't abandon anything just yet.
Okay, and Chris?
All of the evidence is that to get the rate of decarbonisation that we need, we should be looking at and trying out everything. But I'm rather sceptical about carbon capture and storage, despite being an enthusiast for technology and engineering solutions, because what really concerns me is the timescales and leakage. Firstly, the volumes involved are staggering when you do the calculations. If you imagine that for every gram of carbon you burn, you generate 3.7 grams of carbon dioxide. So imagine, we're burning 10,000 billion tons of carbon a year. So the scale of the issue is enormous. But the question you have to ask yourself is, on geological timescales of hundreds to thousands of years, can one be sure that it won't leak back out again? Because if it does, we'll simply have delayed the problem and left a longer legacy for future generations. So I'm quite concerned about it as a solution.
Okay, thank you. Question on law now. David Wood, please.
My question is, why aren't the politicians enforcing the principle of the polluter pays? More specifically, why aren't the politicians legislating that the companies who have made so much money out of the oil industry, that they should be investing some of that huge money into undoing the damage they have done by accelerating a move to renewables. A little bit like we've heard the very encouraging example of E.ON. Why aren't the politicians enforcing that more of the companies do that? It'll be a little bit like the tobacco industry, which eventually was forced to pay up some of its huge profits into healthcare costs for the people who'd been affected by the effects of their industry. So in the end, you know, who is ruling this world? Is it the big oil companies who have got their profits in mind, or is it we, the people, and the politicians who are able to say, no, there are more important things than profits?
Okay, we'll keep that bigger philosophical question looming. If you could focus on the first part, Jake, which is about the reparations and why don't they pay?
Yeah, thanks. No, it's a really good question. I mean, I think the answer is partly politics. I don't think it's just law. I mean, starting with the law, yes, you're absolutely right. The polluter pays principle is a fundamental principle of EU law, certainly. And it finds its way into UK law, mainly from that particular source. And I think it can be enormously sort of constructive and a sort of generative kind of principle that we can apply. That said, I think what you're suggesting is potentially difficult. I think it's potentially probably more politically difficult than it is legally difficult. I know that in legal terms, people are looking at the possibility of using recourse to the courts to explore precisely this kind of angle. So what you would do is you would go to the court and you would say, you know, BP's historical responsibility for a rather significant proportion of carbon emissions over the course of the last 80, 90 years has led to this particular impact on this particular island state over here. For obvious reasons, that's tremendously difficult to do because you've got to prove that to the satisfaction of the court. And that causal link, causation, as lawyers insist on calling it, is a jolly difficult thing to do. And that said, I think, you know, on the basis we have to leave 80% in the underground, on the basis of these companies' historical responsibility for these problems, in principle, I absolutely get what you're saying.
Okay, and Solitaire, do you want to add to that? The sense in which, do we need a bad guy is kind of the background question, I think.
Do we need a bad guy? There's a lot to choose from in climate change, from the companies for which we could ask for reparations from the governments that have allowed this to happen. One of the challenges with bad guys is when you get right down to it, we're it. It is our behaviour, it's our choices. Almost every tonne of carbon can be traced back to one of us in terms of what we ask for, what we pay for, etc. So there's a little bit of a danger with bad guy. There is, however, a lot of positives around heroes and good guys. One of the, almost reflecting one of the earlier questions around carbon capture and storage, to actually focus on, rather than reparations, is to focus on investment. Mm-hmm. And to a little bit like we're talking about taking some of the landfill tax and investing it back into the NHS, I think questions such as yours would get a much more resounding yes from the public if it was, what if there was a tax that was used to put solar panels on schools? So what if we actually hypothecated that back? That's the sort of public discourse story that you can really get some political want behind, whereas actually just beating up on the bad guys bizarrely doesn't actually seem to motivate cultural change that much.
Jenny, if part of the problem is that we're the bad guys, as it were, collectively, including all the gendered problems with that. Part politically, the issue is that we don't like to vote for our own change at some level. So what happens if the climate message is you're all to blame?
I'm not sure if it's that we don't want to vote for change. I think that partly it's because you don't get much choice in the politicians that you're seeing. And, of course, I agree with you completely about polluter pays, of course. But if everybody agreed with me, I'd probably be Chancellor of the Exchequer and or Home Office or something like that. I think that there's a big job to be done in convincing politicians, and I think academia has a role in that, and I also think the media have a role, because at the moment the media does tend to give equal weight to climate deniers as it does to people who advocate that climate change is happening. I mean, witness Nigel Lawson. And so I think that academia has to educate the media and our politicians.
Okay, talking of which, Chris.
Yep. Just very, very quickly, in organisational management, when something goes wrong, as often as not, most of the time, it's because one of three things that should be vested in an individual has become unravelled, and that's responsibility, authority and accountability. And as often as not, it's the accountability that has failed. So somebody has responsibility for something, the authority to deliver it, but they're not held, they're not being held adequately accountable. And the question that you raised is all to do with the accountability of the oil companies for, or the fossil fuel companies for damage that they have caused. They're not being held accountable. Why not? You pointed out that politicians aren't introducing the mechanisms by which they would be held accountable. Well, we all have the opportunity to hold some politicians accountable in a few months' time, and I think we should do so.
Okay, thanks. We'll keep that question in the back of our mind. Nick, I'm going to ask you to come next, so you can hold your answer and build that into that one if possible. So is Annette Smith in the room?
My question was about small actions and large actions. So I would like to ask, how can members of the public be convinced to make small changes in their behaviour when at a national level, questionable practices in carbon trading and futures make their actions irrelevant?
Nick. I think the power of the example is very important here. We've all said that the risk is immense, and we have to try to explain that as best we can. But that's, I think, only part of the story, and I try to emphasise the other part of the story, which is that the alternative way of doing things, where our cities and our energy systems and our land use are much more efficient, much safer. Coal is a big killer, even if you've never heard of climate change, through the poison that it puts in people's lungs, and diesel cars as well. If we think of the different way of doing things and how attractive it is, then I think people are much more likely to say, we see the enormous risks, but we also see that in the short run and the medium run, there's a much more attractive, more efficient, less congested, less polluting, regrading the land, looking after the forest. There's a much more attractive way of raising our standards of living, overcoming poverty and so on. That's absolutely fundamental to the story. And we also have to realise that we're in a hurry, because if we lock in our city structures and our energy systems over the next 20 years, it will be virtually impossible to back out and get any chance of 2 degrees. In that context, the power of the individual example is enormously important. Who's done that? Does it work? Do you know anybody who does that and it works? I've fitted solar panels. They're working fine. I've got a ground source heat pump in our place, you know, and people come and have a look at it. They start bragging about how efficient their car is. The examples of the positive examples of how attractive the alternatives are do matter. And large numbers of, well, those examples come from individuals, from companies, from cities, and so on. So I think the power of the example is enormously important. And actually, people quite enjoy doing these things together. You know, a lot of this is collective. You can't reuse and recycle other than in a community. You can't have combined heat and power other than in a community. You can't have public transport other than in the community, or car sharing other than in the community. These are all things that actually bring people together. So it's not simply in terms of the clean and the less congested and the less polluted and all that. It's also how we live. And so those examples are enormously powerful. So I think the individual really matters in this.
Thank you, Nick. I want to ask Chris in a moment, but first of all, Ro, I know that from Carbon Conversations you sometimes speak about proportionate guilt in this context, which might be very relevant to the question. There's an issue of... Well, you can tell us better than I can.
Okay, I think sometimes as people become aware of climate change, they start to realise what a huge impact their own lives have. Because, I mean, there are very strong correlations between our lifestyles in the West and our incomes and the carbon emissions that we can personally be responsible for. And I think understanding that can be very quite a painful thing. But I think in answer to the question, I think that there is, in a way, we ask individuals to make small changes, and that echoes the fact that we seem to also only expect governments to make small changes and businesses to make small changes. A lot of the work that I do is encouraging people to see that they can make
big changes in their personal lives that we can most of us can actually look quite realistically at halving our current carbon footprints. And as Nick is saying, there's a lot of joy in that because there's a lot of collective activity in it, and you start to produce some of the kind of cultural changes where you find yourself living amongst other people who are thinking the same way and are planning on doing the same kinds of things, are enthusiastic about it, are getting politically engaged as well as personally engaged. So I think we need to move away from the idea of individuals only taking small steps. I think we want them to kind of take huge jumps and run miles.
Thanks a lot. Chris,
I wouldn't obsess about all the guilt stuff. I mean, it's important to show how attractive all these alternative ways of doing things really are. It's also the case that you're being much more responsible, and that's good. But if you attack and get in people's face all the time, I'm not sure that's productive.
No, it's not. Yeah. Chris, briefly, please, because we want to get on.
Very briefly, I was involved in a conversation last night which was slightly different from Annette's issue about the individual. It was about the UK. The UK produces 1.6% of global carbon emissions, so why should the UK bother? You know, why don't we just sit back and let other people solve it, because we're not going to make much difference even if we emasculate ourselves. And the consensus among the discussants was, do it because it's right. You know, the obsession with cost-benefit misses the value of everything. You know, do it because it's morally, ethically right. What sort of a world do we want to live in? We want to live in a better world. So make a statement, be proud of that statement.
Miriam McCarthy's not here, but she had a great question, which is a great follow-on from that, which is connects with the general election coming up. It's basically, how can we encourage political backing and appropriate policy and funding support to tackle climate change in spite of short-term competing political priorities? So I think this speaks to the issue of people may or may not care about climate change on a scale of 1 to 10, but what matters is how much they care of it relative to economic growth, education, health, and so forth. On that, first of all, Jenny, please.
On the London Assembly, when I try to get things done, we often go to the Conservatives, which is counterintuitive, really. But, in fact, when we try to, say, set up a solar project, we have to argue it to get them on board. We have to argue it in economic terms. And once you can do that, it's been a good discipline for us, and, of course, it sucks them into doing what we've been calling the right thing. So, partly, it's about understanding what different groups of people need to hear before they can absorb what you're saying. And I've got three rules of climate change. I hesitate to offer them in this company, but the first is that everybody's got to do something, whether it's global or individual. The second one is you have to think long term. There's no point in doing something that makes messes downstream, like biofuels, for example. And then, of course, as Al Gore said, there's no silver bullet. There's only silver buckshot. And we all have to remember those when we're trying to work towards convincing people.
OK. Does anyone want to add about the election? Who's particularly keen to speak about how climate change becomes a bigger issue at election? Jeremy.
Yeah, I mean, there's one huge drama that could really resonate and connect with everything that we've talked about so far in the election, and that is the shale narrative here in the UK. As everyone here will know, we have a government that is kind of half or two-thirds hooked on it, and they're pushing this narrative to ludicrous levels. David Cameron was in Davos saying that he's going to frack his way to cheap gas on such a scale that manufacturing industry will be brought back to Britain. Now, this is lunacy. And easy to prove as such, because right now the shale narrative is coming off the rails in the United States in a slow-motion train crash. So if this becomes realised and socialised, and already it's realised in places including the Daily Telegraph, with articles from their senior international business editor, if it's socialised and the government is forced to do a 180-degree U-turn, and it's the currency of the election, the question will be, where do we go next?
Okay.
And the answer to that is going to be the right answer. There's nowhere else they can go.
Right.
So this is huge.
Okay. Chris, briefly, and then I'll take Jake.
Yeah, I think we should just not forget, we should celebrate that in 2008, the Climate Change Act was passed with all party support. And although the press and others, for a bit of drama and interest, point out that there are those who are now perhaps less committed. By and large, it seems to me that even though they don't put it very high on their agenda and they're not talking about it much in the run-up to the election, there still is a political consensus that something needs to be done. And the UK has led the world in this respect. The UK Climate Change Act is an innovative instrument which, was it 50 other nations in the world are sort of considering of adopting in one way or another.
But Chris, if Britain is a climate leader, Jake, why is fracking not a climate issue?
Why
hasn't it been framed, perceived in public as an environmental issue, at least as a climate issue? It's been an environmental issue, but not a climate issue.
I'll say a couple of things. I should probably out myself at this point and say I spend a great deal of my time working on shale gas, working on fracking. I think it's two aspects.
Against it,
I should say. Yes, indeed.
Just checking.
Francia's position is clear on that. I think the first point is one that I think Jenny's already touched on, isn't it? Which is paradigm. Which is that when you're in economic circumstances we've been in for the last 5 years, it becomes terribly difficult to articulate arguments, as Chris has mentioned, based on what is right or wrong, as opposed to what leads to, notionally, to growth. I think the secondary difficulty, surely, with shale gas is that the arguments around growth and around economic benefits are pretty tenuous. I should probably defer to Lord Stern on this, but it seems to me that they are exaggerated in the extreme. And the third point seems to me to be that there is actually a degree of fluidity in the run-up to the election, and as a result of which we have actually seen parties changing their positions. The SNP, for example, the Scottish Nationalists, have changed their position on shale. That's put pressure on Labour, who in turn have put pressure on the Tories. So actually you are seeing a degree of fluidity amidst this green bounce.
Thank you. I'm going to go rogue on the schedule. And Nick, since you're on the panel, we have a chance. Your view on fracking briefly, please.
You've got to distinguish between using gas and where gas comes from. If in the short run, over the next 10, 15 years, we substituted gas for coal as we moved very rapidly to develop renewables, that could stack up to a sensible strategy because of the time it takes to get the scale of renewables that you really want. And the if managed well, gas is about half the emissions from coal. You'd have to make sure that it was a bridge, so you'd have to announce right now that within 10, 15 years, not more, you need carbon capture and storage, or you have to phase that out and move over to something else. But we shouldn't dismiss, and I come back to the same argument that Chris and I were using, if you find ways which can radically reduce emissions in the next 5 or 10 years, you should not dismiss them. But that is gas for coal. Now, there's a separate question, and really I think the Prime Minister was economically illiterate on this one, and I'm in print and saying so. If the South Africans produce more gold and the marginal cost of mining gold in South Africa is quite low, do you sell that gold to the South African people at the cost that you mined it? You don't. You sell it on the world market. So producing, because Britain's quite small, producing gas, it would only be a bit, but you know, in relation to the world supply, you're selling into a world market. You wouldn't really reduce the price in the UK. That wouldn't make any sense. So the idea that somehow this is going to drive a whole period of growth, this doesn't seem to me to make much sense from the economics, even if you'd never heard of climate change.
Great. Thanks very much. Okay, a question from Alex Watson, please.
To tackle climate change, do we require a spiritual shift, one where we move from pursuing happiness through consuming products to one where we find happiness through our relationships and ourselves?
So we mentioned paradigm shift already. Some people believe that climate change is such a big issue that talking about the next 10 or 20 years isn't enough. We have to think of something more transformative. Where are you on that?
I think it comes to part of the heart of the conversation that we have about climate change, because we're not actually talking about climate change. We are talking about culture, and we're talking about our place in culture, our relationship with each other, our relationship with the world. When you get right down to it, solving climate change requires us to essentially solve everything else. And that's also the promise, that solving climate change solves everything else. Solving climate change can alleviate poverty, it can create access to energy in places in the world that currently are living in a medieval energy system. It improves our health, our well-being, it makes us thin, it helps us sleep, and it gives us better sex.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That is the positive narrative around why we would want to do this, but there's still wants. They're still desires. And for, I believe at the heart of part of this movement, there is a conversation about, do we do what's expedient, and do we take the actions technologically and culturally that feed into the discourse that we already have, or do we try another way around trying to speak to people in a totally different discourse around spirituality, about meaning and around connection? And I actually don't resonate with that language at all. Although I know that many, many other people do. I find it uncomfortable. It's not how I speak. I want to make action on sustainability. I want to make those small behaviours you spoke of earlier something that people would want to do irrespective of climate change, because it saves you money, it improves your health, it connects you to your community, and that solving climate change becomes a added benefit. But I do know that that discourse... enormous number of people, including a number of millennials, respond to it. So what we need to be able to do is create several stories around climate change, all of which are resolute, cheerful and confident, and preferably that don't argue and blame each other all the time for being the problem.
Okay, thanks a lot. Raul, can you disagree with that? I think you probably can.
One of the first things which we do when people join one of our carbon conversations groups, which are they're just these small facilitated groups, 6 to 8 people coming together to talk about climate change and people's responses to it and carbon reduction. One of the things we ask them to do is to hold a conversation with somebody else in the group about where in their hearts they find the strength to deal with this. And we offer them a whole list of statements, some of which would come from the major religions of the world, and so might offer a spiritual perspective, but some of which come from a lot of other different kind of values perspectives that are not specifically religious. So one of the things we're asking people to do is to find a place in themselves that gives them the strength to act. And so this may be a sense of community, it may be a religious belief, it may be a sense of deep connection to the natural world, it may be a sense of care for others, it may be a sense of family, but whatever it is, it's important to find that point.
Okay, thank you. So,
can I add one?
Yes, sure.
And it's also relates to the question of the election. It's talk to your children. On the whole, the geography teachers in the country haven't done a bad job. And most of the children now of the last who've been educated in the last 10, 15 years, our students who come through into the university system, most of them understand this pretty well. And listening to your children, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Prime Minister, they've all got children starting to get into ages where they challenge and where they explain to their parents what the problem is. And I think that's enormously powerful. The great climate science communicator, the greatest in my view, was Steve Schneider, who Chris, you'll remember Steve, and we sadly lost him 3 or 4 years ago. And he used to play the guitar, and his big song on all this was Graham Nash's Teach Your Children Well. And those of you who know that will know that a little way in it says Teach Your Parents Well.
Gosh, thank you. And I'm going to give all of the panelists, because there's 7 of them, keeping in mind that we have Paris talks at the end of this year. As some of you will know, we've heard this before, but there's this big international meeting at the end of the year that's going to save us all. Maybe this time it'll be different. What I want the panelists to say on the basis of our prior discussion and more generally, in about 30 seconds, if you could possibly let us know what your expectations of that meeting is and how hopeful you feel about it, starting with Jeremy and moving across. Thanks.
Yeah, well, I'm very hopeful, but not because of the politicians. I just think that we've got lucky with the circumstances, and it's 10 months to Paris. And that 10 months is going to be so redolent with drama, much of which has got nothing to do with climate change, but is deeply connected to it. And I've just got one concern that I've come over as too much of a sort of technology, centric guy who thinks that that's the answer to everything, and I don't. I don't think we can shop our way out of this problem. I have deep sympathy for the cultural aspects to it. But I just offer two quick thoughts about where technology connects with that. Renewable energy in Germany, almost half the renewables coming on stream at the moment is owned by individuals, farmers, and communities. Very, very important. And then the other thing is going to the developing world, all over the developing world, people are learning that really the survival technologies are the way to go. And my company set up a charity, as some people may know, SolarAid, which does solar lighting in Africa. And every time a solar light goes into a home, we immediately displace kerosene. And there's a microcosm there for what can be done all across the fossil fuel value chain.
Thank you very much. Jake?
Yes, I think I'd echo rather a lot of that, actually, Jeremy, to be honest. Look, this process has been going on for 25 years. You know, we've kicked the can down the road rather a large number of times. That makes me, I'm afraid, rather cautious in my expectations. I think politicians and governments probably are behind the public mood. I think they do need to catch up. I think there is real scope for change. But I suspect that further talks and further change will be required in due course. I don't see this as a final answer.
So, Solly, culturally, what do we do to make it work?
I feel very positive about Paris because I always feel positive about Paris. So the reason why I feel positive about Paris is it gives another reason of all the reasons that you might have to talk to your friends, your neighbours, your family, your annoying brother-in-law who's a denier, not just about how afraid and terrified and depressed you are about climate change, but how incredibly excited and positive you are about a world that has... use the very best of us to solve it.
Great. We'll go to Ro next. We'll break the current and go to the end and come back to the centre.
My thoughts are about what happened to a lot of people who are working on climate change after Copenhagen, which was a sense of what I came to call post-Copenhagen malaise, which was the difficulty of dealing with the huge disappointment that happened and a kind of collapse amongst many activists at that point. So my hopes for Paris are that we can come through it in a different spirit, whatever the outcome is, such that whatever the outcome is, we're able to carry on fighting.
Thank you. I should say that I'm deeply involved in the process of Paris, and I'm a member of the small group, which is the Friends of the Chair, advising Laurent Fabius and Laurence Tubiana, who are the two people charged by François Hollande to deliver. And I've been working very closely with Christiana Figueres, who's the Executive Secretary of the UNFCCC. So this is a view, as it were, a bit from inside. And rightly or wrongly, I've been at the last 10 COPs, with all the ups and downs that there have been. I think there will be an agreement in Paris. It is unlikely to be a 2-degree agreement. The numbers do matter. If we are about 50 billion tonnes CO2 equivalent a year in emissions now, if you add up the pledges that are on the table, which are Europe, US, China, about nearly half of them, about 45% of the world's emissions, it looks like the sum total of the pledges in Paris will be above 50 billion where we are now, and we should be well below that for a 2-degree path. So the pledges will add up to unambiguously more than a 2-degree path. Not with all the leaning over backwards and soft shoe shuffles, you won't be able to pretend it's not above the 2-degree path. So they'll build into Paris processes for ramping up and meeting fairly frequently to see how those targets can be raised. So there'll be an agreement. It won't immediately be a 2-degree agreement. And there'll have to be quite strong process for seeing how you can ramp up. That's my forecast, but all forecasts, as we said, are subject to uncertainty.
Okay, thank you very much. You heard it here first. Okay, thanks. Jenny, please.
I don't expect Paris to measure up to any of my expectations, but I am an optimist, so I probably have far too high expectations. There will obviously be a lot of scientists, and they will be advising their politicians about the way to go, so I just hope that they are listened to. Can I just say quickly about the election? I'm afraid I've been answering the question before the one that I've been asked to answer. Lobby your representatives. Go to every single hustings, write emails, write letters. They all count when politicians start making up their minds about things. And on fracking, Balcombe, where it was the seat of all the tension between fracking companies and protesters, is now producing all of its own electricity, or virtually all of its own electricity, by renewables, because they just hated the thought of going with fracking.
Okay. Thanks very much. Chris, well, you don't have to have a guitar story, but if you can match Nick's sort of eloquence on the John Nash stuff.
That would be hard, but I'll just answer it straight. I'm reasonably optimistic. There are, after all, very positive signs, the agreement between China and the US. And remember that Copenhagen was when President Obama was coming in, and we all had high hopes that he was going to make a great statement. He wasn't able to do it. But now he's in a different position. He wants to leave a legacy, and he and his Secretary of State, John Kerry, I think couldn't be bettered. So I don't think we would ever have a better alignment of the planets in terms of American political commitment to this. And we see India in an interesting position. They're going to be a very important player too. So there are a lot of positive signs. In addition, the people who run the process learned a lot at Copenhagen, and the preparations for Paris are much better thought out. So, for example, the commitments are being made now so they can be reviewed. So there's not going to be a sort of car crash situation that we had in Copenhagen. So all of that is very positive. But I agree with Nick that what matters is to get the instrument in place so that we can stop arguing about the instrument and start arguing about how to use the instrument in an adaptive decision pathway sort of way. And the Montreal Protocol was a huge success because of that. When it was first introduced, it was not as stringent as it ultimately became. But the point is, once the instrument was in place and on a yearly basis, people could talk about, well, you know, what is the science telling us? We need to turn the volume knobs up or down. And then the final point is that people are very cynical about the whole UNFCCC process. You know, there are 20-year-olds who weren't even born when the process started. But
21.
All right. But there is a very powerful argument that it's given the umbrella beneath which all sorts of other positive actions have been taken in the major cities, the C40, in business and so on. It's raised an issue that other people have said, well, I can't wait for that. We're going to act anyway, and I think it will continue to do that. So I'm positive about it.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. All that remains for me to say is thank you to a few people. Thank you to the Climate Change Collaboration for making this work possible. Thank you to our partners, COIN, who helped to develop some of the content for this event. And thank you for coming, and thanks most of all to our panellists. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.